Webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, Director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602 or toll-free across the United States. It's 1-877-753-3341. And now, with today's topic, here is James White.
And welcome to The Dividing Line on a Tuesday morning. Here's the situation, folks. We have an all-new setup here. Not only last week was it challenging doing this via Skype from London, but now that I'm back here in sunny and beautiful Phoenix, Arizona, we are trying a number of new things today, so we're going to have some whoopses. In fact, we had a whoops 1 minute before we started. We had a whoops. But we're going to have a few more whoopses just to bear with us today. These things. Here's the situation. First of all, TweetDeck is up and running in front of me. Dr. Oakley 1689 is my Twitter address, and if you have questions or comments, inviting all the Ergen Canner fans who believe that it is inappropriate, wrong, evil of me to dare to ask for honesty and integrity amongst Christian leaders. Now, I know I just poisoned the well, didn't I? But that's what I'm doing, and it's shocking to me the responses that I'm getting from people who really believe that evidently as long as you say Jesus, then you can say anything else along with that, and everything's fine. If you would like to contact me via that means, that's fine. We'll go that direction. We have a new way of contacting The Dividing Line today, and a lot of you have been waiting for this, and that is via Skype. You can contact us at dividing.line. Now, my understanding is that that doesn't show us as being online. We'll fix that or not. I'm not sure. All depends. Learning curve here. But it's dividing.line, and you will be able to get through to us at that address. Just put in dividing.line. What will happen is if you hit the phone call button, your phone call will be refused initially. I suppose you could just try texting initially and say, I would like to get on The Dividing Line, give your name and where you're from, and then Rich will get back to you on that. He will call you back when it's time to put you on the air. And I've noticed that the Skype voice quality is significantly higher than that which we have on the phone lines. And of course, we have the regular phone lines. I hope they're working. Are they working? Good. It's very – even have issues there, having to change out a chip. And, you know, when you upgrade a computer, BIOSes change and all sorts of stuff. Hours were spent yesterday trying to get this whole thing to work so that we can have multiple means by which you can contact us and so on and so forth. So 877-753-3341 is the toll-free phone number, 877-753-3341. I could use a little more of myself in the headsets. All that has changed as well. That sounds a little bit better there. That helps a little bit. But we'll be doing a bunch of things. We already have our first Twitter question. What time is The Dividing Line today? very good. It is on right now. well, handle the first question fairly easily. Probably didn't offend too many people other than the person who probably wrote in and is now going, "Duh, why did I ask that question?" that's how you'll be able to get hold of us today. So that's where we're going to get started there. A few comments to get started, and then I see we're going to be having some questions about 1 John 5:1 on the program today. Nothing surprising about that, however, but we'll be taking a look at that. We have been discussing it in the videos that we've been doing of late, so you might find that to be an interesting discussion. But you can call in today on your questions. You can ask about the trip to London, the debates with the Muslims. You can ask about the open-air preaching on Friday evening. No, that was not a picture of me doing the open-air preaching. That was a fellow by the name of Rob, who heads up that group at Leicester Square. I was one of the people that forms the group around him that attracts other people. And then I was to start looking for Muslims to talk to. And I did for about 90 minutes talk with a number of Muslims in that particular context. Very different conversations. It was very interesting. Maybe we'll have time talk about that. We can talk about the ministry in London, the fact we want to go back again next year in February. We're building some momentum there. More and more people are getting excited about it. That's come up. We can talk about the Erigan Canner situation and the infiltration of postmodernism and humanistic thinking into the church that is being seen in many of the responses that are being offered, or the sad circle-the-wagon Southern Baptist mentality that has been illustrated very, very clearly in the responses that have been offered as well. And we can discuss 1 John 5:1. We can discuss the issues around Reformed theology. Isn't it funny? I have dared to point out issues of basic, simple integrity, openness, and transparency in regards to the claims that Erigan Canner makes about himself, about his debates, made about his debates. His bio page remains off of his website as of today. I'm not sure exactly what that means, but it's been down for a number of days. But, of course, on that bio page, he had claimed to have done debates with religious leaders, not just Mormon missionaries, but religious leaders of various sundry religious groups, including Islam. In I think the last rendition had 13 nations and 40-some-odd states. The past had been 11, and interestingly enough, the number of states changed and went down. I'm not sure how that happens. But anyway, issues regarding the integrity of making those kind of claims when your entire claim to fame is you are an apologist. You are a former Muslim. You are an expert in these things. You're the head of the global apologetics program. You're trying to bring paying customers into your school. And I believe that there is a necessity for integrity. No one so far has ever accused me of claiming to have debated someone I have not debated. Not once. I haven't heard anybody say, oh, well, you've claimed to have debated Zulf Karali Shah. Well, I did. Because there were live people there. There's videotape recordings of the encounter. Well, you've claimed to debate Shabir Ali. I have, 4 times. And hope to again in the future. And we can start going down the list. Well, you claim to have debated in 3 different countries. Yeah, I have. United States, United Kingdom, and Australia. No one's raised any issues along those lines at all. In fact, the sad thing is the vast majority of people who have been coming after me with fork and tong over the past week or so have done so very clearly without even taking the time to read what I have said or why I have expressed my concern about the Erigan Canner situation. The vast majority of them have not read my books. They've not viewed the debates, or they've been very selective in what they've looked at. There are some who have, but the vast majority have not. All they see is, you're not supposed to say anything about anyone who claims to be a Christian. Well, folks, I've never been that way. From the time this ministry started, we dealt with things like the Word Faith movement many, many years ago. And always, the first major groups we dealt with were who? The Mormons, Jehovah's Witnesses, and Roman Catholics. What do they all claim? They all claim to be Christians. And so if you're going to, you know, attack us, so at least try to do so with some understanding of where we have stood for over 25 years now. I have made a firm defense of the fact that there are many who make false profession of faith in Christ. Now, just because I disagree with someone doesn't mean that I'm saying they're not a Christian. I'm very clear about which groups I believe are not Christian, and I am very clear about the issues surrounding the difference between disagreeing with someone's theological formulations. I have never, for example, condemned Dave Hunt to hell. I've never sent Chuck Smith off to the flames of perdition. But so many people who are attacking this ministry right now refuse to allow us to define our own grounds of differentiation and definition. Just because I have criticized someone like a Brian Broderson doesn't mean that I have sent him off and put him in the same category as a Daniel Peterson from BYU or a Dave Armstrong of Roman Catholicism. We clearly make differentiation between these various groups. And just because I disagree with someone doesn't mean I'm sending them off to hell. And so we have labored over the years. There are I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of bytes of information sitting on our website that have been written over literally decades now that I think are very consistent in laying out what we think are the very definitional issues. And so I think it's extremely important to address these particular subjects and to do so carefully. Why have I done so in regards to Eric and Cantor? Well, here's this. This just came in from Zachary B. on Twitter. Since our primary witness as a church is through our unity, John 17, do you think it might be do more harm than good to constantly tell the world while you disagree with people who appear to also be followers of Jesus? Now, that's a very, very good question. And a lot of people, we shall be one. In what? What's our unity in truth? Did the Apostle Paul violate that interpretation of John chapter 17 by writing Galatians? By anathematizing men who claim to be Christians? Did he feel he was somehow violating this concept of unity when he had to point out that there are those who are not Christians who claim to be? Why is it the majority of New Testament books warn against false teachers? If that is the way we are to understand John 17, that unity is to be based upon allowing for this huge, wide, contradictory definition of the Christian faith, then it would seem to follow that the New Testament is an incoherent document that cannot give us any guidance whatsoever because the New Testament writers did not follow that interpretation. By the way, I will take Twitter questions that are somewhat relevant to what I'm talking about. I just had a question on dispensationalism and covenantalism. No, not the topic today. Not even close. You need to clarify something? All right, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't want there to be any confusion. There are a number of people who are coming in through Skype. They're making that initial contact, and I don't want them to be confused. I think some people are just getting on the contact list to get it listed, and others may be intending to get in the queue. And so if you want to actually get into the queue and line up to call in on Skype, you actually have to attempt to call me.
They can't text you?
It's a little confusing right now. I want to make sure that I'm not calling somebody who didn't intend on the air at all. You know. So let's just make sure that I don't. If I see that red button, then I'll do the don't answer thing, and that cues them up.
Okay. All right. Thank you, sir. I appreciate the fact that we are almost providing far too much access here, which, by the way, is a tremendous contrast to Eric and Cantor, who I have asked to answer these questions openly, but I haven't even got an email back. But we are making ourselves available and open in that way. Now, before we go to our calls, we're lining them up here, but I wanted to address a few things. I wanted to address a few things about this issue of criticizing a Christian leader. I would like to see Eric and Cantor truly repent of what he has done. But there is a major problem. People have been saying, look, he did. He repented. He said he was sorry. Why can't you just let it go? Well, here's the problem. What did he repent of? He spoke of some misstatements where he said, I have never intentionally misled anyways. That means he is claiming that all of this was mere misstatements. There was never any intentionality on the part of Eric and Cantor. However, when he gets to the situation about sin, he says, finally, there is a legitimate complaint which I must address, namely, referencing a Muslim scholar that I have never met. That's Shabir Ali. And if I had not written to Eric and Cantor from London last week, having myself contacted Shabir Ali to verify the facts before I did, would this have ever happened? He says, listening to the audio, I honestly have no idea who I was referencing. But it certainly could not have been the man I referenced. Now, if you go back and listen to what he said, I have some serious problems here that I have asked honest questions about. I am not for a moment questioning that every one of us can make misstatements. I've done it. And I could name the wrong person that I debated. And I've given examples. I've debated Abdullah Kunda and Abdullah Al-Andalusi. Now, how many of you could very quickly differentiate between those two names? Most of you can't even when I say it. Both were overseas. So would it be understandable for me to say, well, you know, Abdullah Kunda once said, and actually quote something from Abdullah Al-Andalusi. That would be fully understandable. Here's where the difference is, folks. I've debated both of them. There's videotapes of both of those debates. Eric Encantor didn't debate anybody in Nebraska. That's the difference, my friends. I know that many of you can see this. And some of you are going, yeah, we know. But it's the people who are contacting me going, oh, my goodness. Why can't you just let this go? Because the issues have not been answered. Bring up the audio, Rich. I want to make sure you hear what we're talking about. Here is Eric Encantor, two times in 2007. This is twice. This is two different places he's speaking. So this happened multiple times. How many times did it happen? We don't know. Maybe it happened in classes. Maybe it happened in other places. I don't know. But here's Eric Encantor.
Grace and the atonement. Every debate, Abdul Salib, Nadir Ahmed, Shabir Ali, every debate I've had with these men, they always end at the same point. So what if Jesus did die? Because the Quran teaches somebody died. So what if Jesus did die? What's that matter to me?
Radically redefined, grace with Allah simply means he does not kill you.
Mm-hmm.
He allows you life, and that's grace. There is no such thing as grace being unmerited favor given to one who could not do for himself. You can do for yourself in Islam. One of the number one lines that Shabir Ali, the Muslim apologist, gave me at a debate which took place in Nebraska was, why does one man have to die for me? What does one man's death have to do with my life? And this is Islam.
Okay, now, may I say something? What he's talking about is true. And in fact, Shabir Ali has raised those points in debates with me because I debated him on the crucifixion in Seattle. And we actually debated the subject. So what he's saying is true. Here's my greatest concern here. He says true things, but he joins them with exaggeration and falsehood. And folks, that is incredibly offensive to me because this is the area I work in. I'm the one that has to talk to these people. Me and Sam Shamoon and David Wood and Nabil Qureshi, the people who are actually doing these debates, we have to talk to these people. And those of you who are saying you should just keep your mouth shut, do you not understand what it's like to be on the front lines? How can I walk up to Shabir Ali and shake his hand once again and look him in the eye if I will not point out that there are people who are misrepresenting the Christian faith and even saying true things? I would rather that Eric Encantor was some wild-eyed Benny Hinn type guy, but he's saying true things about Islam. But then to pad his resume, he exaggerates. He makes things up as he goes along. That's the problem, my friends. Look, I know that my critics like Peter Lumpkins and Pastor Rogers and stuff, they don't bother to look at this stuff. But those of you who know me, you know that I spent, is it last year, 2008, I forget exactly when it was, sometime within the past year and a half or so. I spent a fair amount of time putting together an entire series of videos responding to a man by the name of Yusuf Estes. Now, Yusuf Estes is well known amongst Muslims in the United States. And why is he well known? Well, he's on the Dean Show all the time. Why is he on the Dean Show? Why is he looked to as a leader? Because he claims to be a former Christian. And people who once were a part of another religious faith are automatically granted some kind of expertise in that faith when they address the subject. People believe what they have to say. And the Muslims believe what Yusuf Estes has to say. The problem is Yusuf Estes is grossly ignorant of Christianity. Grossly ignorant of Christianity. And I did, I believe, if I'm recalling correctly, there's a playlist on my YouTube site. I believe it was 8 videos I did demonstrating that Yusuf Estes has no earthly idea what he's talking about. Now, this is what I'm talking about. If I'm going to point the finger at Yusuf Estes, say, look, just because you claim to be a former Christian does not make you an expert. Here's where you're wrong here. Here's where you're wrong there. How can I, with integrity, look at myself in the mirror in the morning and refuse, out of partisan loyalty, to point out that Ergun Canner has pulled the same stunts in padding his resume and claiming to have done things he never did? And folks, the people that have provided this documentation have told me there's more coming. This is the tip of the iceberg. And if some of the things that I have been told are going to be documented to me, and I've asked for documentation, I've asked to hear it with my own ears. And notice, Ergun Canner did not say that any of these had been altered. He did suggest to someone that context has been taken out, but he never has said that these things have been altered. This is him talking. Once that stuff comes out, I'm going to be asking those questions as well. And I simply submit to any Christian, how can you claim to follow him who is the truth? And close your eyes to these things. I do not understand it. What has been the response from the Peter Lumpkinses of the world and others to attack me personally? Attack my scholarship, attack where I went to school, attack me for being a hyper-Calvinist, all that stuff. That's what they've decided to do. Not attack what I've written. They can't provide any counterexamples whatsoever where there's a parallel between anything I've ever claimed and what Ergun Canner has done. Because every time I've claimed to debate somebody, guess what? I did. And you can look at it and you can listen to it. And whether they want to admit it or not, I did pretty well in the debate because I prepare for my debates. That's one of the things that really bothers me about this. And that's one of the things I jumped on about Shabir Ali. I spent months of my life preparing to debate Shabir Ali so that the people of God would be edified. And some guy comes along who has never even met the man and puffs his resume by claiming to have debated him in Nebraska. I bet you Shabir's never even been to a brat in Nebraska. Where in the world do you set up an Islamic debate in Nebraska, for crying out loud? I mean, come on. And so I asked some honest questions. You want to, when I wrote to Ergun Canner, his first response to me was, I misspoke. Really? Okay, Ergun, here's some questions. Who did you debate in Nebraska that you confused with Shabir Ali, and when did you debate them? Because you put specific words in Shabir's mouth. You don't do that by a mere misstatement. Who'd you debate? He's never answered. But folks, there's something even more embarrassing here. He says he debated Abdul Salib. Abdul Salib is a Christian. Abdul Salib means servant of the cross or the crucified one. No Muslim would ever have that name. It's a pseudonym. And so we've asked him, when did you debate Abdul Salib? Are you claiming to have converted him when he was a Muslim and now you're just using his pseudonym? When did this debate take place? When? These are simple questions, folks. And if the statement is, well, I just misspoke, is true, then there should be easy answers to simple questions. But you see, that's the problem. Because going back to his statement, he says, I honestly have no idea who I was referencing, but it certainly could not have been the man I referenced. For this unintentional, but nevertheless horrible mistake, I repent for saying his name and I ask for forgiveness of all those who heard it. Wait a minute. Repent for a misstatement? You can apologize for making a simple mistake, but repentance is for something that's sinful. He says, sin is sin, and if I am dumb enough to say something like that, I should be man enough to deal with it and aim to never make such a grievous error again. This applies to any time when I wrongly use names. I shall be more careful. Dr. Canner, multiple times using names of men you've never met? You see, if it was a mere misstatement, there's nothing to repent of. If you actually made it up, then you shouldn't be repenting of something, an unintentional mistake. You repent of that which is intentional, not that which is unintentional. Repentance means you're going one way, you turn the other way. Does that make sense? Does people understand where the problem is here? So what's happening is his followers now, who seem to be extremely enamored with him as an individual, go, well, that's enough. And I keep saying, what did he repent for? What about all these other issues that have been raised? What about all these other questions? Well, I've been told just to go on with my work and ignore these things. You can't do that in the situation you're in. Now, I want to get to Lee in a second, but I want to read. There is a gentleman, I posted his email on the blog last night, I believe. And when he first contacted me, he was rather unhappy with me. And I used his email as an example of this kind of attitude that people have. And he says, quote, Mr. White, as a Southern Baptist, I'm very angry with you with what you are doing right now. Dr. Aaron Cantor is an incredible scholar and man of God. Why do you incessantly attack him all the time? I have personally benefited from Dr. Cantor's ministry and believe he is an intellectual giant who is doing a great service to the SBC. Please stop attacking fellow Christians and stick to debating Mormons and Muslims. So I pointed out that this gentleman clearly isn't dealing with what I've said in my statements and what my concerns really are. It's not a matter of attacking anybody. This is not an attack. This is a matter of integrity, folks. This is simple truthfulness. And evidently, we're not allowed to do that in the SBC. I sort of learned that back in 2004. I learned the political aspects of the SBC back in 2004 when I dared to accurately and in a scholarly fashion disagree with Mark Seifert of Southern Seminary. The fireworks, the circling of the wagons, the politics. I had one Southern Baptist editor tell me he would never work with me again because I had attacked a fellow Southern Baptist professor. And then he admitted later he had never read a single word I had written on the subject. I learned a lot. That there are people who are willing to take actions merely based upon, well, I've been told you did something. Notice, when I was contacted and told that Ergen Kanter claimed to have debated Shabir Ali, I asked for proof. And when I got the proof, what did I do? I contacted Shabir Ali. And only once I had the audio proof and confirmed it with Shabir Ali did I contact Ergen Kanter. Boy, it would be nice if Peter Lumpkins and his ilk had half the integrity to do that. So this particular gentleman named Mark and I have gone back and forth a number of times. And he demanded to call into the program today to respond to my personal attacks. He is very emotional. He is emotionally driven, and his argumentation changes from point to point. And I gave him the phone number, gave him the Skype, said, feel free, call in. But I'm going to utilize your call as an example, because it's painfully obvious to me, even from what you've just said in your emails, you haven't even read my response to Ergen Kanter. And once I pointed that out to him, 5 minutes before the program, he emailed and said that he was not going to be on the program. In fact, he said, I am sorry I'm going to pass on coming on your show. You are just setting me up to attack and ridicule me on the air. I would like you to address two things, however. One is the accusation that you have an obnoxious personality. Does not the scripture say that an elder must be hospitable, 1 Timothy 3? Well, this is not a gentleman who has ever been to my church, and so he doesn't have really any grounds to talk about my obnoxious personality. There are people who are postmodernists do not like non-postmodernists. And in fact, while postmodernists dislike modernists, they dislike pre-modernists even more. And evidently, from this man's perspective, if you believe that there is absolute truth and that there should be integrity in the Christian ministry, you have an obnoxious personality. He says, In this email exchange, you have insulted me and attacked me personally. I think you should follow the example of Francis Schaeffer, who is very respectful and congenial with those he disagreed with. In other words, since I identified him as emotionally driven, his arguments were irrational, those are attacks. He refuses to differentiate between the observation drawn from his own words and personal attacks. They're all the same thing. And that's a postmodern concept, because in postmodernism, everything is a reason to be offended. He said he was deeply offended by my comments. Well, what if I just said, well, I'm deeply offended by yours? What does that accomplish? It accomplishes absolutely nothing. I'm not a postmodernist. Yes, I mean, I'm offended by his attacks, but I don't care. That's not the point. I'm irrelevant, folks. I'm just to do some incredible things. The Lord's given me great blessings, a wonderful opportunity to speak his truth. But if I get run over by a truck tomorrow, it doesn't matter. The kingdom will go on. It's only people who are really stuck on themselves that get easily offended. I'm just not that easily offended. Evidently, Mark is. He says, I have firsthand experienced your lack of social grace, and that on at least two occasions after your debates, I've observed you up close and personal and have seen firsthand that you have a lack of patience for those who may disagree with you. Mark, how about some examples? Which debates? As I think he was at the one at Biola. And give me examples, because there are lots of people standing around after Biola listening to me to talk to people. And if you think that telling someone that they're wrong about something is impatience, well, okay. But I think your problem, Mark, is with Paul and the apostles more than it is with me. Postmodernists find premodernists to be offensive. Has nothing to do with whether you're being kind to someone. In fact, Mark, I would say that the kindest thing you can say, and isn't this amazing? This guy is defending Ergun Canner. Ergun Canner, who has at one point in video said he was born in Istanbul, which he was not, and then he called himself a name, which is worse than the N-word. And he's defending Ergun Canner. I wonder if he wrote to Ergun Canner and called him to account for that. I wonder if there's consistency. I wonder how you became an elder of that small Reformed Baptist church out there in Phoenix. Since I and almost everyone that I know who has met you in person have went away with the distinct impression that you are unloving, uninterested, and detached from the people who ask you questions at your apologetics events. Now, who's engaging in ad hominem here? If I identify his postmodernism, I'm attacking him. But I'm sure that in Mark's mind, he's not attacking me. Now, people who've never met me, they may be going, yeah, that's what I've heard too. But the people who've actually had me at their churches and their events are probably going, wow, where's this guy coming from? Then he says, secondly, and more importantly, while we're on the subject of padding one's resume, please address your alleged PhDs from Columbia Evangelical Seminary. Is that an accredited seminary? Or is it like LBU, where Robert Morey and others have cut corners and received academic credentials that they, in fact, do not deserve? Are you, in fact, a PhD scholar from an accredited seminary or university, or did you get your so-called PhD from a degree mill? Please address your obnoxious personality and your academic credentials, okay? I think I know why Mark didn't call in today. What do you think? I think most people can see that the term obnoxious personality can go both directions. But notice the personal attack here. First of all, I don't claim a PhD. It's a THD. Since 1998, our website has had a full discussion of the accreditation situation with CES. I have always said that I have to defend the validity of my scholarship by what I do. I defended this in my statement recently, which he clearly did not bother to even read. Remember, here's a man commenting, and he hasn't even bothered to read what I've written. See, remember I mentioned back in 2004, this editor who told me he'd never work with me again. And when I asked him, please testify, show me where I did something wrong. The response was, well, I didn't read it. This amazes me, because I can very honestly say it offends me, because folks, I do my homework before I say someone has said something. I invest my time in trying to be accurate for the glory of God. Why don't other people like Mark do that, I wonder? I have been wide open with the path that I took to do my doctoral studies. And if you can take what I've produced in apologetics, my debates with Bart Ehrman and John Dominic Crossan and Marcus Borg and John Shelby Spong and Shabir Ali, and the wide variety of people I've engaged the books that I have produced on a scholarly level, and since I claim a Ph.D. in apologetics, if you can look at that and say, no, that's well below the standard for a Ph.D. in apologetics, and fine, make your case. No one's ever even tried. And everybody who calls CES a degree mill, I challenge you, I dare you, I demand, go buy a degree. It ain't going to happen. In fact, the vast majority of you would not pass the first class. Because the first class, taught by Rick Walston, is about how to write. And it's one of the toughest classes. I've had many people who've tried, couldn't get past it. That's why no one since 1998, when I graduated, has ever come up and said, oh, look, I just got a degree from there, and I just bought it. You can't. It's not possible. It takes years, and it takes work. And, folks, I will put the work of one of my current students at CES in his papers up against anyone in any accredited seminary anywhere without even batting an eye. Thankfully, a lot of people are starting to discover that it's not what you pay, it's what you do that determines your scholarship. So thank you, Mark, for your kind and gracious emails talking about how I am so obnoxious. It's a sad thing, Mark, but as I said to you, you have been so deeply influenced by postmodernism that you don't even realize it. All right, much more that could be said. I don't know how this is coming through. Since you said, who do we need to go to first? You need to tell me. I have no way of knowing. But you said someone was unhappy, so let's get the unhappy people out of the way first. All right, Lee in Fort Worth.
How you doing, sir?
Hi, doing good.
Well, I go to a Southern Baptist seminary. I'm a member of Southern Baptist Church, mm-hmm. but I'm also a Calvinist, and I'm just looking in on your situation and following your ministry. And do you think that by attacking Dr. Kaner, I mean, you're making some pretty good accusations here, that in a sense you're attacking the integrity of the Southern Baptist Convention because they've elevated him to be the president of one of their leading seminaries, Liberty University. He comes and he speaks at Southwestern, Southeastern, different seminaries. So in a sense, and also he speaks at the convention, you know, at the Southern Baptist Convention pretty much every year, him and his brother. So basically when you attack Dr. Kaner, you're pretty much undermining the credibility of the Southern Baptist Convention, because obviously Al Mohler and Paige Patterson and different Southern Baptist scholars don't have these enormous problems that you do. So in a sense, you're basically saying that they're elevating a guy that's discredited himself, he's basically lying, and that either the Southern Baptist Convention is turning their backs on them or not doing their homework. So there's an issue here because this is one of the leading, you know, apologists in the Southern Baptist Convention that speaks at all their, you know, major conferences, speaks at their different seminaries. Yet you're saying that this guy's basically a liar.
Lee, what makes someone...
person that defends the faith.
Okay, and with whom has Eric and Kaner engaged in that activity in a public venue?
According to your standard of, you know, formal academic debates, you know, I'm not going to say that he has. Obviously, he's, you know, I'm not.
Okay, Lee, can I ask you to explain to me in his bio page, which is now down, he claims to have engaged the leaders of multiple world religions in debates in 13 countries and about 40 states. The natural meaning of language would lead you to conclude that you could actually ask to listen to these encounters. Isn't that the case?
Well, according to what he said, I read his, you know, his apology or whatever on his website, that basically there's two different views of what a debate is. Like if I say I'm at a coffee shop and I meet a Muslim and I interact with that person, we have a debate. In his mind, that's a debate. I agree. I think what you do is better. I've been to a few of your debates, and
Lee, if you are the head of the global apologetics program at a major seminary, and you claim to have engaged religious leaders but cannot name a single one, and you use the term debate, and then when challenged on that, and then, in fact, you make up names. You say you've debated Shabir Ali. You've debated Abdul Salib, who's a Christian. Do you believe that as Christians, We should simply close our eyes because, well, like you said, the Southern Baptist Convention has elevated this guy and he's allowed to speak all over the place. So shouldn't we just close our eyes to these things? And who cares if the Muslims point out that he doesn't know the difference between the Shahada and the beginning of Surah Al-Fatiha? What does that matter? Isn't it more important that the Southern Baptist Convention have credibility? Lee, do you see the problem here? I have to meet these people. I have to debate these people. I shake their hands and look them in the eye, and I tell them that Jesus Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. Does that not put me under some kind of obligation to be truthful about what I say and how I engage them?
Dr. White, I really respect what you do and what Jay Smith and Josh Lingles does. You guys are like, you know, on the front lines. You're really doing the work. I'm not saying that Dr. Kaner has done these things, but I guess what I'm asking you is, I mean, I really, first of all, I just really respect what you're doing in London. I mean, you're putting yourself on the front line. You know, you got people praying for you that you don't know of.
But I appreciate that, Lee. I really do. And I want to understand where you're coming from because I can hear your heart. I do not want to unnecessarily cause division in the body. But at the same time, there has to be some level of accountability. And if the folks at Liberty, and Lee, I can tell you this, I can't tell you who because they would be gone a second, but these issues are not unknown to the leadership of Liberty University.
Well, let me just make this argument, okay? You're not a Southern Baptist, but you're an outsider looking in. Okay, and I'm not saying you don't know the culture, but I would say that there is a culture to the Southern Baptist Convention.
Yeah, there
and
is.
Our churches are interconnected. Allegedly, there's 16 million Southern Baptists in the nation. I'm not sure if that's accurate.
I like your use of the term alleged there.
But I guess what I'm saying to you is this. All these seminaries, Southwestern Baptist Seminary, Southeastern, you know, Midwestern, Golden Gate, they're all connected and they serve the Southern Baptist Convention. When you have a gentleman like Kaner going and speaking at these different schools and these different conferences, conventions, they're speaking in the name of the Southern Baptist Convention with the blessing of the Southern Baptist Convention. By attacking Dr. by making these statements, in a sense, you're saying that Al Mohler or any of these Southern Baptist leaders are basically turning a blind eye.
Lee, I don't think Al Mohler has the time or the inclination to be aware of the issues in relationship to Ergen Kaner. I don't believe that. And I don't believe that it is appropriate. And remember, I was raised as a Southern Baptist. I was licensed as a Southern Baptist minister. I graduated from the Southern Baptist School. Grand Canyon College was a Southern Baptist school when I graduated from there. And I have taught for Golden Gate since 1995, just finished teaching a class on Islam and atheism in Mill Valley at the main campus in January. I taught that class 3 days after my mom died. So I do know the culture. I do have connections there. And I believe that Southern Baptists should be the first ones to be concerned about this and would be the first ones to say, that man has not been elected my leader. That man has not been elected to speak for me. And in fact, if I'm not incorrect, as I listened to the Southern Baptist podcast recently, SBC Today podcast just last week, Ergen Kaner himself said, I don't even speak for my wife. We're Baptists. So he disavowed the exact same thing that you are now saying. He said, no. Don't you dare say that I speak for the convention because I don't. So I don't think he would say that. But I agree with you that it does raise an issue about the personality culture in the Southern Baptist Convention. And that is, especially when it comes to a star convert, someone who can claim to be a convert from X is given a pass. And so if what you're saying is you are raising a challenge and you're challenging Southern Baptists to step up to the plate and to hold men accountable, yeah, I am. And I don't believe it's an attack upon someone to simply point out that the statements that they're making in the realm in which I have been laboring. And I've only been laboring this field for a little over 4 years. I'm the newcomer. But as the newcomer, I already have significantly more experience, documentable experience, than Ergen Kanter has.
Oh, there's no question. I'm not disagreeing with that. And if I was a multimillionaire, I would have you guys debate somehow, some way. I would have you guys. It's kind of like Manny Pacquiao and Floyd Mayweather Jr. Eventually, those two guys are going to have to fight. And I think, you know, there's a lot of people out there that would love to see you guys debate. I think a couple of years ago, you know, you guys should have debated. I'm not sure how that all fell apart.
Well, you know, all the documentation is on only one side's website, and that's ours. We have the signed documents. When people will take a signed document and throw it under the bus 10 days before the debate, you cannot trust they're going to do anything that they say. All right, that one isn't even really arguable. Anybody who actually takes the time to read the documentation, only one side's provided it, and it's my side. We were open and above board from the start. Even when we started the meetings, Dr. Kanter said, let's keep this private. And I said, no, not going to happen. These comments have been made publicly. This is not going to be done privately for that very reason. But see, debating Ergen Kanter, yes, greatly enjoyable on other issues. That's not what this is about. This is about the integrity of the entire apologetic effort to respond to Islam.
Are you basically, I mean, are you saying that ultimately Dr. Kanter is a liar? That's pretty much what you're saying.
I am saying that Dr. Kanter has not just misspoken, he has made things up as he went along, and until he provides a meaningful account for the issues that have been raised, and there are more issues that are going to be raised in the future because he's a very public person. He's gone on television saying these things. He has now admitted that at least twice in 2007, he misspoke about debating Shabir Ali. Lee, do I have meaningful grounds for asking him, how do you mean you misspoke? You said you debated someone in Nebraska and they gave argument X. Who was it that you debated in Nebraska who said this? Why, if it's just misspeaking, why couldn't he respond to that question?
Do you think that he gets going, he's preaching,
yep,
and he just makes like misstatements, or I mean, are these actual intentional misrepresentations?
I think he gets into the moment. And this is what I guess you didn't read my letter to him, because I said this in my letter to him. I said, Ergen, I think what happens is that you get into the moment, you've got the audience listening to you, and you feel the need to add gravitas to what you're saying. And so instead of just simply saying Muslims believe X, he puts that argument into the mouth of some Arabic-sounding person that he claims to have debated, and that makes it more exciting. But he's not debated any of these people. Every time he names names, he's named three names that we've documented. Shabir Ali, he's never met him. Abdul Salib is a Christian. Nader Ahmed, oh my goodness. At least he had an email exchange with him, but the irony is Nader Ahmed never raised the argument that he claimed he did. So how can you name three people like that and not be right about a single one of them? I can understand mixing up one name, but coming up with the name of a Christian, and in every single one of those instances, it's just simply untrue? Don't you think that given that he spoke these things publicly, this wasn't him sitting around at a restaurant someplace, this was at an evangelism conference, Lee? If you're going to say those things, shouldn't you have an answer for the questions that are being asked? And shouldn't the Southern Baptist Convention want to hear answers to these things? Don't we hold our leaders, if they are leaders, accountable? When I stand in the classroom at Golden Gate and teach on Islam, should I be able to make things up as I go along? Or should I accurately represent the Islamic faith to the best of my ability?
Well, I guess ultimately, when I'm thinking about this, either these guys like Dr. Gary Habermas, he teaches at Liberty, you know, Dr. Falwell, son there, Jonathan Falwell, and the whole staff of Liberty University, or you know, the philosophy department or whatever, apologetics department, is either turning a blind eye to this or they're putting up with this. I'm not sure why. I mean, what I'm saying is that if there was this glaring of errors, wouldn't the school itself, and
I would like to think so. I would like to think so, Lee. But I'm scared of one thing. First of all, I do know that there are people there who simply roll their eyes when you ask about Eric and Cantor. And by the way, I did need to correct you about something. Liberty's not a Southern Baptist school. It's not a Southern Baptist seminary.
Since when is that?
No, it's always been.
No, Dr. Falwell,
he became a Southern Baptist, but that does not mean that Liberty Seminary is under the control of the Southern Baptist Convention. It's not. It's not like Golden Gate.
You're saying it's like an independent fundamentalist
yes.
type kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
Okay, I stand correct. I have to look into that. I mean, I'm not here in any way defending Dr. Kaner. It's just what I'm saying as a Southern Baptist looking in on this, that there's a guy here that's making these statements. Because I respect you. I respect what you're doing with Muslims. I'm not sure how you're even alive right now debating these people, like, you know, Jay Smith. I mean, I've seen Jay Smith on these videos get slapped in the face by these Muslims and, you know, in the Speaker's Square or whatever there in London.
Square,
I'm not sure how you're even alive right now with London being filled with all these Muslims. So I respect what you're doing. I mean, I've seen you debate these people. So, I mean, I've been, you know, but it's just basically the whole integrity of the Southern Baptist Convention is at stake here, because what you have here is this guy speaking. I mean, he spoke in Louisville or this past, you know, convention, you know, right?
I mean,
he speaks at these.
Lee, brother, I hear your heart, and my heart breaks, because what you're talking about here is a major problem. It is a major problem in evangelicalism. We exalt people, and this is an issue of personality. It truly makes me incredibly uncomfortable when anyone ever says to me, oh, I'm a fan of yours. I don't want fans. I don't matter. I don't want, quote-unquote, followers. I don't want to have to try to impress people. The only thing I want remembered about me after I'm gone is what I said that was true.
Can I ask you one last question, though? I mean, here's this, you, one of the leading apologists in the evangelical world. I mean, if I'm you, like back in the 90s or whatever, and you're doing all these debates, I mean, couldn't you get like a PhD from University of Arizona or Arizona State? I mean, I don't understand why you went that route.
Oh, that's easy. That's simple. It's called being first and foremost committed to my local church. I am a churchman first. I have always said that. I believe the highest calling is service within the church. There is no office of apologist, and there was no place that I could go at that time that offered a degree in apologetics.
Like, you couldn't have got a degree in philosophy. I mean, you got a degree from
I have no interest in that. I have absolutely positively no interest in that. In fact, I am very concerned about the fact that there are many Christians who invest much of their life producing work that will never be read by anybody but five people and will never benefit anybody in the church. I have some serious problems about how we do education, how we indebt people up to their eyeballs and expect them to go out in little churches and be happy with what they've got there trying to pay their bills. I believe education should be something done in the local church. I don't see anything in the New Testament outside of 1 Timothy 2:2 that would give me any indication that that kind of activity is appropriate. And I gladly embrace. And by the way, the certain gentleman we're talking about did his PhD work in South Africa, by distance. They don't have accreditation issues there. And so I would just like to suggest to everyone, unless you go around and read people's doctoral dissertations, and amazingly enough, I'm one of the few people who do. I had Bart Ehrman's doctoral dissertation sitting on my desk when I debated him. Almost nobody does that. But I would like to suggest to people that the best way to determine someone's scholarship is by what they do, not by where they went.
Isn't it both, though? I mean, the very fact that you
no,
have, like,
not.
5 degrees shows you that you think education is important, right? You went to Fuller, and then you
I
went.
I did.
I mean, it shows you that, I mean, something's in your mind that you had some kind of, it just seems, you know, just as you look at it, being in this realm, that it just seems like it's kind of like cutting a corner or something like that by, like, saying
well,
you have
if you can
degrees.
Look at the work I've produced and say, you cut corners to do that, that's fine. If the work that I produced, however, is very much in line with what the ministry and my service to my church required me to produce, then I leave that between me and the Lord. And I have never had actually take the time to look at the work I produced and demonstrate that it's subpar, that it's beneath anything that would be produced in any accredited context.
Do you really think that book, The God That Justifies, I mean, I've been following your ministry for probably about 15 years and looking at it.
For a D-Min, yes. Ever read any D-Min papers?
Yeah, of course, I've taken demon classes, but what I'm saying is this. You said something earlier when you were on that monologue that you'd hold up your scholarship to anything out there, basically, that, you know.
In my field, yes.
No. I mean, you look at,
I said in my field, Lee.
James Buchanan's book, The Justification.
Right.
That's infinitely more of a scholarly book than what you put together in that God to Justify. I was disappointed. You know, I looked at that book, The God That Justifies, and I thought this was good. People were saying that was like the best book that's come out on justification, evangelical world, since James Buchanan's book. And I looked at that and I said, the level of that is basically like an undergrad college intro book on justification. That is not the scholarly book of all time or in 100 years in evangelicalism on justification. I mean, it's just not.
I appreciate your opinion. I'm not the one who claimed that it was. However, if you give some examples.
No, just a level. I mean, I have to get it out, but just a level. I mean, sir, you read more than I do. Okay, you look at you. We can just compare that, you know, a book by B.B. Warfield or Charles Hodge,
mm-hmm.
or these guys, and you compare the level of writing in that book. It's just not on par with that. And I'm not saying it's a bad book, but it's just not the level of academic, you know, specialization. Or you take a guy like, these E.P. Sanders, you know.
Yeah.
Level of E.P. Sanders or.
And
or,
did you read the part where I specifically said that that's what I was going to try to avoid was that kind of thing? Because I honestly, I've read E.P. Sanders. Did that edify you in any way?
I think the E.P. Sanders, although I reject admirably everything, you know, his whole thing, you know, on Second Temple Judaism and all that thing, but the level of scholarship in that challenges evangelicals to have that same, you know.
Well, we just illustrated a fundamental difference as to how we view what you should write, how you should write, and the fact that, yes, I address the doctrine of justification in a way that is not dispassionate, because I don't know how you can address the very foundation of your daily life in a dispassionate fashion. But Lee, we've given you a tremendous amount of time.
Thank you.
I appreciate your call, and hopefully we've clarified a number of the issues that have been
raised. All right, thanks, sir. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Since Dan called in, is Dan still there? All right, let's go ahead and it's going to completely change the what? Oh, I know, but it's going to completely change the topic. But hi, Dan, how you doing?
Good. How you doing, Dr. White?
Sorry to keep you on hold forever and a day, but obviously,
no
it was worth addressing.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I was calling in. I've been tracking the videos, I guess, on 1 John 5:1 and the order of faith and regeneration.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to chat about that real quickly. The verse kind of says, whosoever believes that Jesus is the Christ is born of God, and everyone that loves him is begotten, is loved as him that is begotten. So I guess it sounds like you were trying to make the point that this verse is saying that regeneration comes before faith. And I looked it up. I guess the beliefs is a present participle and has been born is in the perfect tense. And I kind of saw where your argument was going, but it sounded like the grammar itself couldn't decide the issue, specifically because I guess the has been born was really, when I looked it up, it's relative to when John wrote the epistle, not to the believing. So it's not saying the person was born before they believed. It's saying they were born before John wrote that that specific verse.
How can gegenetai have anything to do when John wrote the epistle? I'm confused.
Well, John, I mean, just from a sheer grammar standpoint.
Yes, from a sheer grammar standpoint, it says pas ha pistou on everyone believing, and then that Jesus is the Christ has been born of God. It's not talking about the writing of the epistle. It's describing the fact that everyone who is truly believing, and in John, that present tense participle is used of true saving faith. This is in the context of the false people who've gone out of the church, so on and so forth, who've denied that Jesus is the Christ, et cetera, et cetera. That's talking about why it is that everyone who has that faith, that Jesus is the Christ, why is that? What's the unanimity? What is the factor that binds all of them together? They've all been born of God. That's why a person believes that Jesus is the Christ. It's a supernatural
right.
confession.
Okay, so I guess my point is that a perfect tense verb in Greek, is the timing of that is pegged to either when it's spoken or written.
The perfect tense verb refers to a completed action in the past that has abiding results in the present.
That's correct.
It doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the time frame of the writer if a particular context is provided. Did you read my did you watch my video where I gave you the two grammatically perfect parallels in 1 John?
Yes, I did, and I guess I'll make a point on that as well. The believing is a present participle, and it's not a one-time, you know, instantiation of faith or when faith starts, but it's talking basically about perseverance. And so the point overall seems to be that, you know, it's kind of a test of assurance that we're given. So, you know, if you've been saved, you can look at your life and say, okay, you know, I can see that I've been persevering in the faith, and that means that I was born again. That's real. So it's not really about the start of faith, the inception of faith. It's really about the perseverance in faith.
Well, I have absolutely no question that the substantival participle hapistuon, which is used throughout the Johannine corpus, refers not only to the nature of true saving faith, that it is ongoing, but that it will persevere. There's no question about that. However, what you seem to be missing is the statement that John makes that differentiates true believers from false believers. There are those who had gone out from the Christian church. They had denied that Jesus was a Christ. They had denied that Jesus come in the flesh. And in 1 John 5:1, we're told that everyone believing, everyone who has this true saving faith that Jesus is the Christ, that one has been born of God. It was not by having that faith they're being born from God. The reason that they have been born from God, that, according to John 1, is God's work. He's the one who causes us to be born again. He's the one who causes us, not the will of man, not the will of a husband, but of God that causes us to be born again. But the whole point is, why is it that anyone continues believing that Jesus is the Christ? Because they have supernatural life. Saving faith is a supernatural thing. And the parallels in 1 John 2:29 and 4:7 bear this out. Unless you're going to believe that in 1 John 2:29 it is by doing good works, doing works of righteousness, that we cause ourselves to be born again. No, 1 John 2:29, the reason that we are doing good works is because we have been born from God. That's the whole point. And
right.
So,
no, I'm sorry. I completely agree with what you're saying. You know, but it relates to the perseverance in faith, not the start of faith.
It doesn't make that differentiation. How can you say that the start of faith preceded being born again, but then to continue believing you have to be born again? How can
I'm not saying that. I'm saying it's silent on that. I'm saying it just doesn't talk about the start of faith. Talks about the perseverance of faith, not the start.
Well, since it is a present tense, anyone who is right now believing that Jesus is the Christ, the reason they are doing so is because they have been born of God. Therefore, a person who says that a person who has not been born of God can have that very same believing in Jesus has a real question to answer, because that would seem to reverse the order that he has here. But thank you, Dan. I appreciate it. We've gone over time even for that, but I think we have addressed the issue fairly clearly in the videos that we've put forward. Wow, that was a fast hour, and we didn't get to most things. People in Twitter, you were throwing all sorts of stuff at me. Unfortunately, 98% of it wasn't about the subject that we were addressing, so I couldn't get to that, but I appreciate the fact that you were listening. Hopefully you can see that we have some important issues to address. It concerns me that we're even having to address these things. If you're going to make public statements as a teacher, then you need to be held accountable for those things. I just don't see how anybody can get around that. But we'll continue with our discussion on Thursday. Thanks for listening. God bless. Bye-bye.
The Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracks. Join us again this Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m. for The Dividing Line.